Any postman getting this letter to deliver would be struggling, wouldn't they? There's not much of an address. You know, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. How do you deliver that? It's not a letter written to a particular person or a particular church or even a particular place. And if you were to open it up so that you could return it to sender, well, the only clue you've got as to who wrote it is James. Which leaves quite a few options. Almost certainly the author is James, the one who headed up the church in Jerusalem, and from the center point of that original first century Christian mission, he writes to the 12 tribes, all God's people scattered across the nations. The Greek for James is actually Jacobus, Jacob. And if you think of that and you know the book of Genesis, you remember at the end of that book how Jacob, the patriarch, gathered his 12 sons to him and addressed the 12 families, the 12 tribes, all the people of God. Well, it's something like that that's going on here. From time to time, people ask me a question, something like, Hugh, what would you say to the church in the UK? Or, what's your message for the church today? And I have to confess, when I get asked that question, I get a little flush of pride. You know, a quiet satisfaction at recognition of my importance and influence that you ask me a question like that. And then I open my mouth and, then I realize my wisdom has run out at that point. James, though, is worth listening to. He's observed the issues that threaten the churches, that undermine and challenge their faith. Not major doctrinal issues, not even nitty-gritty nuances so much as the practical living out of the Christian faith. And now he's writing to identify his concerns, to warn, to encourage. I mean, just turn on a couple of pages to the very last verses of his letter. People often give away so much at the end, don't they? Here's chapter 5 and verse 19. See what he writes here. My brothers, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring him back, remember this. Whoever turns a sinner from the error of his way will save him from death and cover over a multitude of sins. Great thing to rescue someone who's gone wandering. Well, I think what James urges on his readers is what he's demonstrating himself. It's why he's writing the letter. If this thing would work, yes, I've called this series Let's Get Real because that seems to capture James's attitude. He can't stand phony Christianity and he's seen too much of it around. And he won't duck and dodge difficult issues either. Watch how he starts. Do you notice? He faces straight up to Christians facing trials. Not necessarily court cases, more the knocks in the teeth that life gives you. As well as what being a Christian gives you. Anything from illness to exams, disappointments to persecution. I don't know what you were taught when you first became a Christian, but trials are part and parcel of the Christian life. Will it be uphill all the way, the young Christian asks. To the very end is the wisest reply. It would be so easy if only I could believe, the non-Christian says wistfully, disillusion them swiftly, will you? Not by accident, I've called this talk when the going gets tough, not if the going gets tough. Some of you today know exactly what I'm talking about. You're carrying the hurts of some powerful trial of one kind or another. You brought them to church with you. James is speaking right into your life this morning. For others of us, hey, it's bank holiday weekend. We don't have a care in the world. Will you listen just as carefully? This is a lesson we're all going to need. And here's what it brings. How to face trials and know God's blessing. Verse 12 seems to me the summary verse of this opening section. Look what it says there. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. No magic wand promised here. No, if you've got a difficulty, just ask God and he'll take it away. None of that, if you trust God properly, then a life of success and ease will be yours. That's how God treats his faithful servants. No, it's not. No, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he'll receive the crown of life that God's promised to those who love him. There is a crown of life, yes, but that's for the future, not the present. When it comes to the here and now, well, it seems that James has got Jesus' own words ringing in his ears, that strangest of Jesus' blessings. Do you remember? He said, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Yeah, trial's there, all right. And you remember how Jesus went on? Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. Well, watch how James faces us up to tough times. It is exactly along those lines. In fact, the first point he makes is count it pure joy. It's the sort of line that makes you give up straight away, isn't it? Count it pure joy. Watch what he says, though. Look down at verse 2. These are our vital truths. Count it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds. Now, don't misunderstand James. He's not saying, oh, I've got leukemia, how wonderful. Now, that would be to lose touch with reality, not to get real. And he's not narrowing the trials he has in mind. They are trials of many kinds. He's writing to those facing everything from Christian persecution to economic hardship via whatever the school of hard knocks throws at them. And James's point is not how nice. It's that trials are fertile soil for fruitful growth. Trials are fertile soil for fruitful growth. Watch how he goes on in verse 3. Because you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance, endurance, stickability. They can't be grown without trials. The champion's ability to hang in there and produce the winning shot at tennis when it really matters, score the decisive goal at football when you're up against it, take the vital wicket at cricket when it's most needed. You'll only see that. It only gets developed when they're tested thoroughly enough for it to really matter, for you to be up against it, for it to be most needed. And what's true of endurance is true of character. Look at verse 4. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. But there is character that can only be shown through trials. Remember how we're told that Jesus was made perfect through suffering. The writer wasn't trying to tell us that he was imperfect or flawed beforehand, just that there are depths to his godly character that only something like his agony on the cross could reveal. Praying, Father, forgive them, as they nailed him to the wooden beam. Or the love that provided for his mother. Here's your son. John, here's your mother. When his own personal agony might so easily have been totally self-absorbing. Mature and complete. Not lacking in anything. And as I've looked at those words this week, one of the things that struck me is that God is so much more ambitious for me than I am for myself. I would settle for so much less. I'm hoping for a little less temper, a little less laziness, a little less lust, a little more zeal and boldness and virtue. I somehow imagine I can reduce the Christian life to a minor improvement scheme. Jesus wants me perfect. And the only way he can work that into me is through trials. They make me think. They stretch my faith. They grow my character. Quite countercultural, isn't it? In a society that is endlessly trying to protect us from every conceivable kind of danger, we forget that birds can tip their young out of the nest to teach them to fly. When I was at college, I can remember a wise Christian friend saying to me one day as he was trying to sum up my character, you haven't suffered much yet, Hugh, have you? I was rather not. Well, you know, no one likes something that sounds like criticism. And when it's criticism, you sort of feel, well, what was I meant to do about that? But I realized when I calmed down what he was trying to say, there was a naivety. There were sort of holes in my character that were there because I just hadn't seen enough of life yet. Well, I've suffered a little more now. But I certainly haven't always remembered to count it pure joy. It's not the instinctive way we go. Listen to this commentator. I think he puts it very well. Even in these trials of many kinds, the servant of the Lord Jesus Christ is to continue living the life that James will describe. His burden in writing is this: don't put off your life of faith until times get better. Right now, in the midst of your suffering, is the very time to be putting your servanthood towards Christ into practice. The message is clearly applicable for Christians today. When we encounter trials, what do we experience? In most of us, there's probably a mixture or succession of reactions. Fear. What will become of me? Anger. How can they do that to me? Self-pity. Won't somebody feel sorry for me? Envy of others. Why aren't they suffering like I am? And confusion. Why is this happening? With these reactions, we often fall into precisely the problems James addresses for his original readers. A jealous focus on material wealth. A selfish neglect of others' needs. A judgmental spirit and hurtful speech. A bitter fighting with one another. And James says, count it pure joy. He's urging me, as the trials loom up in front of me, to remember this is one of God's opportunities. He's wanting me to think, how can my relationship with Jesus be deepened here? He's promising me there can be a progression to all of this that runs something like this. It begins with the trials, and they will test my faith, and that will develop my perseverance, and that will grow my character. And you and I look at that and think, easier said than done. And James understands that as well. So he starts with count it pure joy and follows it with ask for wisdom. Ask for wisdom. Do trials confuse us? Do they leave us all at sea, not knowing how to cope? Well, here's some good news. Ignorance is not a crime here. Ask God. He'll give us just what we need. Look what he says in verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God who gives generously. Literally, he should ask the giving God. That's his nature. Who gives generously to all, no limitations, as if God has nothing better to do than to give and to give and to give. Who gives generously to all without finding fault. I don't know about you, I can think of 101 good reasons why I'd not give to me. From my lousy track record with what I've done with previous gifts to how slow I've been to ask this time. You know, I normally have to be desperate before I ask. But that's not how God works. Ask, says James, and it will be given to him. You think, I've heard that before somewhere. Yes, because, again, James is echoing Jesus' teaching on prayer and our God. You remember what Jesus said? Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receives. If we're facing trials, there are no questions about God's sincerity. He is working to help us to maturity. Now, the questions James has got is about our sincerity. Am I going there with him? So you see how he goes on in verse 6. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That man shouldn't think he'll receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. Now here's a problem that James has spotted in the church, and it's still very much with us today. The double-minded person. Literally, double-souled. Someone with a foot in both camps is probably how we'd put it. You ever been there before? You know, you've got one foot on the bank or the shore and the other on the boat, and they're drifting further and further apart. And it can only end painfully, can't it? Or wet. Probably both. Well, it's like that when you've got one foot with God in his camp and one foot in this world's camp. The issue, you see, is not, will God give me the wisdom needed to cope with trials? It's, will I trust the wisdom he does give me? Or will I insist on trusting something else at the same time as well? He tells me how, but I want my hopes realized alongside. He'll resource the how to endure the slog, handle the children, cope with the pressure of too much or too little time. I'm still fixed on having an excitingly different tomorrow. He tells me why, for my good, for my godliness, for a deeper relationship with Jesus. And I say, I'll follow, but I must also get my degree, have that job, secure this promotion, find a husband or a wife. God's wisdom doesn't always seem to give me the answers I'm looking for. And I end up confused and uncertain, going first this way and then that. No fixed path to my life, but insecure, unstable. You know how it feels? Yes, some of you know how it feels. You're experiencing it right now. That's where your life is at. And it's not that God won't give. It's that the double-minded, the double-souled can't receive. Count it pure joy. Ask for wisdom. Know your place. Someone once described the letter of James as like a whole succession of wonderful gems. Brilliant in themselves, but you don't quite work out how to put them together. It's a bit like a string of pearls where the string's broken and they've gone all over the floor. You know, you pick them up, they're wonderful, but what order are they meant to go in? And it doesn't need to make any sense. But look carefully. There's an inner logic to this. James is writing about trials, and one of the greatest is economic hardship, whether it comes through the sort of recession that cuts across the board or from the kind of persecution that often leaves a Christian in poverty, certainly economically vulnerable. So he says, verse 9, the brother, the sister, in humble circumstances, ought to take pride in his high position. What does he mean? Well, society may look down its nose at you or blank you, but and James is not insensitive to the grim side of poverty. We'll see that in the next chapter. He's not viewing poverty through rose-tinted spectacles. No, he's just saying, remember the spiritual reality. Don't let the cold shoulder make you forget who you really are. A child of God. A massive inheritance ahead of you. A forgiven sinner. You can't get more privileged than that. Stop the slide into bitterness and self-pity and envy and low self-regard. Take pride in the high position grace has put you in. But James actually has words of encouragement for both ends of the economic spectrum, and most of this paragraph is devoted to the wealthy. Which is a healthy thing for us this morning, as virtually all of us here today would qualify as wealthy. And he's giving us the wisdom to handle the trial, not just of poverty, but also of riches. It's a subtler one, but it's just as dangerous. So he goes on, verse 10, but the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wild flower. I think the rich man's low position, which he should cherish and take pride in, is the same as before. He is just a sinner, but a forgiven sinner, an adopted child of God. Our identity must be in Christ, not in our riches. See, how do you think of yourself? By your job title? By your bank balance? By your achievements? By your influence? Or just as Christian? Christ's man, Christ's woman. What James is reminding me of is that I will not last long as a rich man. 70, 80 years? And most of us have had a good proportion of them. Our wealth, our real wealth, lies in the future inheritance, not what we've got now. That's passing away. Look, verse 11. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant. Its blossom falls. Its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. And as Jesus said, then whose will all these things be? Don't stake your identity on what will not last. One of the perks of being a vicar in the Church of England is that you get a house that goes with the job. And if you're the rector of All Souls, you get a very nice house right in the centre of London that goes with the job. Claire and I keep reminding ourselves, I think it's a healthy reminder to give ourselves, we just say to each other from time to time, enjoy it while it lasts, dear. Yeah, it won't be much longer. The day will come when the job ends, we'll be living somewhere very different. I've got a friend who takes that even further, and I think it's even healthier. He and his wife, they just feel it's a good way to treat anything, however precious, you know, even the family heirloom when it gets broken. They just say to each other, well, that's what it's for. It's heading for the scrap heap. It keeps our feet on the ground. Know your place. That same friend said, those of us who are less well off are to think much on heaven and on our relationship with God. And those who are rich are to think much on the passing nature of this present world. Suddenly, trials come into a different perspective. Count it pure joy, ask for wisdom, know your place, and don't be fooled. So often when we're faced with trials, whether they're just the minor frustrations of everyday life or the major griefs, you know, loss of job, loss of a loved one, loss of a cherished hope or cherished relationship, so often we can start thinking, can't we, what have I done to deserve this? It seems such a natural road for our minds to head down. All as if the trial is God punishing me for some terrible thing I've done, a lie I told, an affair I had, an abortion or divorce from way back in my past. And James knows what dangers lie that way, the bitterness and resentment that creeps in towards life and God. And he tells us straight out, we've got it all wrong. That's not what's going on. Look, verse 13. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. God is not the problem. I've got to remove from my head the idea of God sitting up there jerking my strings, just playing games with me. It's not who he is. It's not how he works. And James hasn't switched tracks here. We're on the same theme. That word for trials in verse 2 and 12 and the word for tempted in verses 13 and 14, they're basically the same root word. It's just that something very different might be going on. And James warns of a very real danger, but not from God. Listen again to this commentator, because I have got to retrain my mind to think very differently from the way it most naturally seems to do. Here's what he writes. In the very midst of a trial, when I'm feeling fear and sorrow and pain, if I'm asked by a friend, what danger or threat is there in your life now that I may pray for you? I'd probably answer, pray for the deadly disease to be healed, or my financial needs to be met, or for people to stop doing the things that are injuring me. In other words, I would think of the chief injury being inflicted by the trial, and my foremost concern would be for the trial to be stopped. Well, that's my knee-jerk reaction too, isn't it? Now, he goes on, comes a word of God that requires a radical change in our thinking. The Bible says the trial itself is not the most seriously life-threatening factor. The greatest danger to me is not the wrong being done to me, but the wrong that may be done by me. The real threat is that when wrong is done to me, I may be tempted to fall into sin myself. You see, that's how he goes on here. And we know the experience, don't we? Look at verse 14. You've lived this. Each one is tempted when by his own evil desire, not from God, from me, he's dragged away and enticed. And then after desire has conceived, has mulled it over, thought it out, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death, that shriveling of life at every level that eventually leads to eternal loss. You see the alternative plans that James is highlighting for us, the patterns he's giving us. The same trials come. And either they test my faith and grow my perseverance and develop my character, and God uses those trials to build me up. Or the same trial can lead to my evil desire starting to work and giving birth to sin, and the sin giving birth to death, and I twist them into something self-destructive that pulls me down. My good friend Mark Ashton, who died just a few weeks back, he used to tell a wonderful illustration of coming downstairs early in the morning, thinking he heard a noise in the sitting room, and opening the door and finding that a bird had flown in overnight because they hadn't closed the window. But as he opened the door to come in, the cat, Twidget, came in with him. And then he pictures this scene around and around the sitting room as the bird tries to stay out of the clutches of both Twiglet the cat and Mark as both are trying to get hold of him. See, the bird thinks they're both dangerous. The bird doesn't realize that Twiglet's trying to catch him to kill him. Mark's trying to catch him to rescue him. And he says, we've got to learn to recognize God as our rescuer. We've got to have the courage to hold our trials up to him and ask him to help us see him in it. Pray for help. Help me understand you have committed yourself in love to me, Lord. Show me your purposes for me. How to face trials and know God's blessings. Some trials are deeply painful and bruising. We shrink from them. But James knows they are unavoidable and gently coaches me to face them. Count it pure joy, he says. God, show me the opportunity. And God calls on me to rejoice in it. Ask for wisdom, he says. And God promises me the wisdom and calls on me to follow it. Know your place, he says, and God shows me my true security and calls on me to stay fixed on it. And don't be fooled, he says. And God reminds me of his goodness and calls on me to live trusting it. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. I don't know whether for you this morning has just been a training exercise for what lies ahead this week, or whether it's emergency treatment for right now. Either way, I know it's vital. God works this deep into our souls.